Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. On this Thursday night, we get to see the first report to emerge from the public inquiry into allegations of foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections on Friday. We hear from Globe and Mail Ottawa Bureau Chief Robert Fife, who helped break many of the stories that led to the inquiry in the first place, about what he's hoping to see and what kind of impact it could have on the Trudeau government. Are acute spells of anger bad for your heart? New research shows that seeing red can actually do some damage. Why and what can the more hot-headed amongst us do to better protect our ticker? We find out. A pilot project to decriminalize possession of small amounts of drugs launched in BC in early 2023 has really been in the crosshairs of late, with a lot of public complaints about a surge in drug use in public. BC is now asking Health Canada for changes to the project, but what has changed? What does it mean for the decriminalization project as a whole? Is it a failure or still a work in progress? Vancouver Police Deputy Chief and the head of the BC Association of Chiefs of Police, Fiona Wilson, is with me with her take. But first, Rod Black has called more than a few magical moments in Canadian sports over the years and others, but nothing will quite compare to the call he made the other night in Milwaukee. After rushing with his wife from Cancun to Wisconsin to watch their son Tyler make his major league debut with the Brewers on Tuesday night, Rod was being interviewed when his son got his second hit of the game, prompting a magical moment as he got to call the play. Rod Black joins me to talk about a dream week for the entire family. Imagine watching one of your kids get their first NHL or PWHL goal, win their first Grand Slam, or get their first Major League Baseball hit. It would be magical for any parent at any time, right? But on Tuesday night in Milwaukee, a name that will be familiar to many, many Canadians watched as his son experienced that incredible milestone. Rod Black may be one of the most recognizable names in Canadian sports broadcasting, having spent decades covering some of the biggest moments out there, from the 92 and 93 Blue Jays World Series wins to the Olympics and the Raptors 2019 NBA championship. He has called countless great sporting moments, but perhaps never quite one like this. Again, he was on hand in Milwaukee to watch his son, Tyler Black, play his first ever Major League Baseball game. And he had a double at his first at-bat. And then with dad given being interviewed at the time, he gets hit number two. And, well, you'll recognize the voice. Have a listen.
I think hand-eye from hockey also helps. There's a base hit to right field for my boy, Tyler Black. Woo! There you go. Oh, there you go. Two for two. Happy birthday, Nancy.
That was incredible. He's got tears in his eyes, guys. This is an incredible moment for the Black family. Congratulations to you guys. What a fantastic day.
Yeah, it's awesome. I think we're going to start drinking heavily.
Welcome to Milwaukee.
We love, right in. We love Milwaukee. We love Milwaukee. We're never leaving.
Amazing. A hit for my boy. Can you imagine being in that situation? He and his wife, Nancy, who, as he mentioned, it was her birthday on Tuesday, almost didn't make it. They got a call the night before while they were in Cancun, Mexico, saying from their son, saying that he'd been called up to the big leagues. And so they planed, trained, and automobiled their way from Mexico to Wisconsin just in time for the game. It caps off an incredible journey for the 23-year-old Tyler, who was drafted in the first round by the Brewers in 2023. The Stouffville, Ontario native, been playing AAA in Nashville up until, well, a few days ago. And he's had a roaring start to his big league career, so much so that he's in Chicago with the Brewers now as they face the Cubs at legendary Wrigley Field. And of course, you know who else is there? The family, including Rod Black, who are savoring every single moment of this dream. And Rod Black joins me now from Chicago. Rod, thank you so much. Congratulations.
Oh, good to be with you.
Matt, you've been on a lot of road trips for work over the years. You've done a lot of sports road trips over the years, but this one must be just undescribable.
It's planes, trains, automobiles, fuzzy brain, blurred vision, sore liver, you name it. It's been everything. It's been a wild ride. I compare it actually to when I called the 2019 NBA championship, where every day we didn't know where we were going to be. Right. You know, based on losses or victories, we were always on the move on my buddy Leo. And it was kind of like that. This is the same because we started in Mexico and I was working there, and We were supposed to stay there for a week, and then we only got there for, geez, less than 48 hours and got the call. And then we ended up trying to get from Mexico to Milwaukee, which is not easy. I can tell you that.
That's a tough trip. That's a few stops.
Yeah, we got the last two tickets like 2 a.m. because Tyler got a late call on Monday night. We got the last two tickets on Spirit Airlines. Right. And we were fortunate to get that. And we got to Chicago. Then we got on a train to the Rent-A-Car place, which took a while. Then we got through customs, yada, yada, you name it. We finally got to the game. And then we found out that Ty wasn't going to play. He wasn't going to start. So I kind of breathed a little easier, but I went, oh my gosh, we did all that. But I did know he was going to pinch run or pinch hit at some point, but I thought later in the game. And then, as you probably saw, things unfolded the way they unfolded. And quite frankly, for him, they unfolded for him in a real dream sequence.
No kidding. And just to be able to be there too, because you were in, was it Cancun? I mean, you were a long way away. What was that phone call like from Tyler saying, hey, I've been called up?
Yeah, I was there to speak and so vacation as well. Speak vacation. I was doing a thing for the Automobile Dealers Association of Ontario, MVRO. Great people. Had done a session that night. We went for dinner. I was supposed to do another session with Liz Manley the next day. My wife and I went for a nice dinner with these great folks, and we were going to play golf in the morning. And it was late; it was like 11:30 in Cancun, and we went down. I said, "Come on, let's go down to the beach." It was beautiful, you know, the ocean and the moon and stars. It was really kind of quite nice and feeling the breeze. And she looks down at her phone; she had 6 missed calls from Tyler, and
wow,
had an inkling. Yeah, I had an inkling last week that something could happen. I didn't think it would happen that quickly, but clearly it did. And frankly, even though it's been a tornado trying to get here, and I still need probably it's going to take me a week to get sleep, but it's been really good. It's been so worthwhile. And, you know, you want to be there for your kid when any of your kids, whenever they do something. And quite frankly, any of us as parents, and if you want to be a good parent, you try to get wherever they were. If they were in the Sahara Desert, I'd find ways to get to them. So it's been certainly been worth it.
Tell me about the interview, because of course everyone's seen that. And I was, you know, I've watched you for years. So at first I thought, is Rod Black calling a Brewers game? And I thought, wait a second, they just gave him the mic and you just clicked in, right?
It was kind of different. Like we were there because he happened so fast, and obviously they knew where we were sitting. And I'm a guy who, when I go to games and watch my kids, I like to sit down the baseline. I don't like being around other parents. I'm not unsociable. I like watching the game by myself. So it was nice. We were up. They wanted us to be, they had seats down really low. I didn't want to be there. I just wanted to be up. So we were about 20 rows up. Perfect seats though. Nice. And so he got the double at his first at bat, which, you know, we didn't have our phones. So we left him
you
in the car.
Didn't have your phones. Wow.
We had the car because we were so rushing. And it was good. It was good though, because we would have been on our phone the whole time. People were like blowing him up. And then, you know, he had got the hit and we were cheering. And then I kind of knew based on what they do. I know what I do as a reporter when they got parents there. You know, a sideline person, you go down, get a little interview. What's it like? Yada, yada. I turned at one point. Then I saw Sophia Minart from Bally's. And we watch a lot of their games. So it was neat to meet her there. And she's a great young lady and great reporter. And there she was. And I knew, oh no, here we go. And then she called, said, do you want to call it? I said, no, I don't really want to call it, but I'll interview if you want to say some, and whatever happens, happens. Because they never know. Like, he could get hit by a pitch. He could strike out. He could pop out. There's a lot of stuff that can happen. So it was absolutely nuts. And then she just started talking, and then it was what it was. It was kind of organic. It was like actually calling a game again. It was kind of cool, but it was like right in the middle of the stands. So it was very unique.
Yeah. And just the way you delivered it too, that's a base hit for my boy. I mean, it was kind of a magical moment. I'm sure part of you just locked in as all broadcasters, you kind of lock into it's kind of almost brain memory, but you added all this interesting stuff in it. It was your wife's birthday too, right? So it was just really magical moment.
You honestly can't make it up, right? No. You can't make any of that stuff up. And it was her birthday, the way we got there. He's always kind of had a flair for the dramatic when it comes to first hits. Wherever he has been, college, his first at bat was a hit. You know, went the other way. And his first A ball professional game was a hit. You know, everywhere he's kind of been. And it's so unique too, because it was the team, one of the teams against Tampa Bay that he hit one of his last workouts before the draft. They really were on Tyler at the time. And so, you know, kind of ironic that, you know, Kevin Cash, who was hitting grounders to him, is on the other side. And it was a crazy game. If anybody didn't see it, there were brawls. There was some tension, but it was really cool. It was like a really cool moment for him, for sure. And, you know, we were lucky enough to be there and soak it all in.
What was it like? Did you go down? I mean, I was just watching you in the dressing room after the Jays won the World Series in 93. And I was thinking, I wonder if Rod went down to the dressing room after the game to sort of see everybody and what it was like.
Well, we did go down because it's the most unique place I've ever been around. This Milwaukee, they're such nice people. They're the nicest people ever. And one of the things about Milwaukee is that you can go anywhere and everywhere. So we did go down to the dressing room, and Ty was there, came out after. Like, I had tons of interviews, obviously, get the Gatorade out of his eyes and out of his hair. And he had the ball and a little trophy case, which he gave to his mom for her birthday, which was really special and emotional. And then, you know, what's so funny about that 93 is, if you check some of it, you know, I think I interviewed Joe, obviously, and Robbie Alomar, and, you know, Dave Stewart and the rest, whoever was there, Paul Molitor.
Ricky Henderson, I think, too. Yeah.
You know, the most important person, actually, years later, was a guy named Rob Butler, the Canadian on the team. And Rob Butler was the guy that really helped Tyler at a young age. I got to know Butsy really well. And Ty went to their, you know, to their team, their kind of academy at about 12. And they were so, so instrumental in his development and giving him the juice at a young age. And so it is a full circle moment, but it was really cool. I still got goosebumps.
Amazing. I mean, I'm older now, so I look at Ty and I think, oh, he must have been born about the same time that you were covering the World Series. No, not at all. He was born like 7 years later.
No, which is crazy. Here it is again, a crazy connection. He was born on the day he was born. I had to do a game. Wow. I was actually broadcasting a game later that day, and Joe Carter and I ended up sleeping in Joe's room that night because we had Tyler in the morning. They had a huge billboard up, you know, congratulating Nancy and I for the birth of Tyler Alexander Black. And then also, which is really an incredible connection, the Jays won that day. And on that sheet, you know, 23, almost 24 years later, were so many people who played in that game or were part of that game, including the anthem singer, who was the wife at the time of Andy Stewart, who was Tyler's hitting coach at one time. Andy Stewart was in the bullpen. Alomar was playing. Butler was there. Paul Spolgerek, who became instrumental in his development, was there. Just so many people were there. And it was like, man, you know, he was kind of, I guess you could say he was born to play.
On the day he was born, he was on the Jumbotron, right?
He was on the Jumbotron. And then 16 years to the day, he also had a chance to play at Rogers Center on his birthday. There's like crazy connections and symmetry. He was playing in a East Coast Classic of Team Canada against a group from Boston that came up. So the tons of scouts at that time. But yeah, it's a movie script.
Rod Black, longtime Canadian sportscaster, is with us this half hour talking about just an incredible story this week. He and his wife, Nancy, were in Cancun for sort of business and pleasure. It was Nancy's birthday, and they get the call that their son Tyler has been called up to the major leagues for his first game with the Milwaukee Brewers. So they make a mad dash from Cancun to Milwaukee, which I guarantee you is not a direct flight. And they get there in time to not only see him get his first major league hit, a double, but then Rod's on, basically given the microphone in the middle of an interview there as he gets another hit. And he basically calls it, which was just an incredible moment. Rod, I was thinking of all the things you've seen in your life. I'm sure you've already seen this written, that it is the best call you've ever made. I don't want that. I hope that doesn't sell you short.
No. Well, I've had so many great ones, like great moments. I've been around great moments. You know, I've been so lucky to be around great moments. And you know, I everybody always asks me that question, like, what's the favorite? And honestly, it goes back to 92 and 93 and first time World Series.
Right.
And, you know, check a World Olympics and being here. Yeah, you hang around this business long enough, you get lucky. Carlos Delgado had four home runs, Mike Weir's, Masters. You go through all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's a call. I wasn't getting paid for it. It was the cheapest one. But it was, honestly, it was the most worthwhile. And it was, I'm a dad right now. Like, before Tyler used to be, you know, Rod Black's son, but now I'm a proud proud to say that, you know, I'm Tyler Black's father. And it's like, it's so different. The fact that I was there, somebody asked me earlier today, would you ever consider like broadcasting games? And he was playing. And I said, I don't think I could do that. Even though I've been considering it, like getting back in the game, doing some baseball, I've had some opportunities to do some baseball games. It's not so much like that's cool being around it. There's days like I'm critical. I'm also a dad and I'm also a broadcaster. Yeah. And like, you know, the days that you suck, man, I'm going to call you out on that. Like even if Eddie struck out the other night, that call might not be as viral as it is now, or maybe it would have been even better. And I would have said, oh my God, Tyler, you suck. You struck out. Or you got hit by a ball. Maybe down the road, there might be a game where I'm off the team and he's in the game, but I think I would defer to my partner. But there is something special about the parents being around. And I love that. I used to love just watching how they, you know, I was the person being what Sophia was the other night sometimes and getting the parents' reaction and their story. Tyler's story is probably one of the most unique.
Well, Rod, I'm sure I'll let you get back to what's been a magical journey. Enjoy the game tomorrow, the Brewers and the Cubs. That's an age-old rivalry, so it should be awesome.
Yeah, at Wrigley Field. I mean, again, the kids live in a dream, and we're just glad we're along for it and, you know, trying to support them as much as possible. It is a great time.
Rod, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You know, there's been a lot of yammering this week in Ottawa on Parliament Hill about BC's pilot project to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of hard drugs. And that's been in place for well over a year now. It was introduced back in January of 2023. And really, this is how it works. It allows adult drug users in the province to carry up to 2.5 grams of drugs, not a lot, just a little, for personal use without facing any criminal charges. But again, it's been a really hot topic on Parliament this week. Such a hot topic that the leader of the official opposition, Pierre Poilievre, actually got ejected from Parliament for unparliamentary language for referring to it, the project, and the Prime Minister this way.
He continues to allow those drugs to kill the people in our hospitals and on our public transit. When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko Prime Minister?
No, no, no.
Yeah, that got Poilievre booted. And of course, there's been some anger about that. But part of it was they were really sticking to this idea that somehow the decriminalization policy is directly tied to the number of overdose deaths that we're seeing, which of course makes absolutely no sense because, and I live in BC, so I witness this stuff every single day. Decrim has been a problem. It's been a real problem because it's sort of allowed unbridled public drug use. And that's angered people in public places. I mean, there's been anger about it. Now they're trying to change it a bit to get an exemption from Health Canada to allow them to crack down on the public use and so on. That's what Poilievre was referring to when he talked about use on buses and in hospitals and so on. But I mean, overdose deaths are at record highs in Alberta where there isn't decriminalization. It's not the problem. It's not that problem. The opioid crisis is far broader than that. But it's even the NDP government now is admitting that the decriminalization pilot project is running into some issues. Here's the Premier, David Eby.
It is a whole array of people that we have seen and that we have lost in this province as a result of the toxic drug crisis. We're doing our best to try to keep them alive, to get them the opportunity to get into treatment, to rebuild their lives. And also, we need to ensure that our communities are safe and welcoming for everybody.
Indeed, and therein lies the problem. So what are they doing about it? The Mental Health and Addictions Minister here in BC told me today that the Government of Canada and the Government of BC are committed to working together to review this request. So they're trying to get it done quickly. And here is her federal counterpart, Yara Sachs.
We understand that this is urgent, which is why we've asked them to respond to us on an urgent basis so that we can address this.
Indeed, address it now. BC Conservative MP Brad Viss says the federal addictions minister needs to visit the province to see the toll that decriminalized drugs is having on areas like parks visited by families and kids. Have a listen.
This is out of control. You talk to any British Columbian, and they can't take much more.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little over the top. So what we thought we would do here is try and get some sober analysis of what exactly has happened. Because there are other jurisdictions, obviously, such as the City of Toronto, that are looking at following in the same path as this and decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of drugs. We talked about this on the show recently. Portland had this in place. And they rolled it back because the public drug use just wasn't working. They weren't seeing a decrease in overdose deaths. So the problems were outweighing the benefits and they decided to scrap it and do something else. But again, part of the problem, I mean, tens of thousands of Canadians have died in this opioid crisis that we're living through still. And it is absolutely tragic. So obviously we want to see people, we want to see authorities try things out, right? And the idea of decriminalization was essentially to free up police to concentrate on other things. That's what it was about. Not put addicts into the justice system, treat them instead, treat it, an addiction, as a healthcare issue. That was the point. Of course, there have been unfortunate and now exceedingly unpopular consequences from it. One of the people who knows this issue really well, because not only is she now the deputy police chief of the Vancouver police, or deputy chief of the Vancouver police, when she started out, she used to walk the beat on the infamous downtown east side in Vancouver. So she knows her drugs, she knows her policing, and she knows how the law interacts with it. Joining me now is Vancouver Police Department Deputy Chief Fiona Wilson. She's also president of the BC Association of Chiefs of Police. Deputy Chief Wilson, as always, thank you.
Hi, Ben. Great to be here.
I guess just for listeners not in BC, a reminder of what decriminalization, because it was broadly supported by police chiefs in this province, what it was meant to achieve from the outset when it came in, why chiefs were supportive of it.
You know, Ben, I think we all recognize that we needed to take a new, different and progressive approach to drug policy in this province. We were at the pointy end of the stick with respect to the illicit drug overdose crisis. And, you know, I think like everyone, we really wanted to try and do something that could move the dial on the tragic number of deaths that we were seeing in community.
Right. And how was decriminalization meant to help that? Because I guess at its very basics, it was meant to sort of keep police doing other things other than sort of, you know, stopping people for possession of possession of small amounts of hard drugs.
Yeah, and Ben, just to be clear, you know, it's been many, many years since police have really focused much enforcement effort on simple possession. We had a directive from Crown in 2020 that basically says they will not approve charges for simple possession except in exceptional circumstances. So, you know, certainly in a place like Vancouver, we pretty much had de facto decriminalization. But really, I think something that's important for everybody to know is that decriminalization was always only seen as one small puzzle piece in a much, much larger picture. And, you know, it was about reducing stigma. It was about directing people to pathways of health, keeping them out of the criminal justice system. Because really, one of the things we all agreed about was that we don't want to criminalize people simply by virtue of a drug addiction. And so that's sort of the background of decriminalization and what it was all about. But it was supposed to be in conjunction with a number of other initiatives to try and help people not start using drugs, to keep them safe when they were using drugs, and then to give them, treatment options when they decided that they wanted help.
Right. And I know you're not a policy expert on this. This is not what you do. You're a police officer. But at the same time, what we've seen happen in Portland, and I think there's been some concern about what's happened in British Columbia as well, maybe differently in different communities, but it feels like there weren't enough puzzle pieces put in to allow this to succeed.
You know, Ben, you nailed it. Like, one of the things that police across the province did before the exemption request was even submitted was we flagged a number of concerns that we had. And one of those concerns was the matter of public consumption, but there were other ones as well. We really wanted to, and we expected to see, a dramatic increase in health services for people who use drugs. We have long advocated for treatment on demand, for example, so that when our officers do come across somebody on the street who is, you know, their window is open and they are willing to get help, that we have somewhere where we can take them or direct them to get that help. We also had a number of concerns initially with the threshold amounts, which were up at 4.5 grams, along with concerns related to driving and also the age that the exemption applied to.
Right. Tell me a bit about, because the one that's gotten most of the attention is the public consumption. And, you know, I'm in Victoria. You walk the beat, you walk the downtown east side. So you know this a lot better than I do. But I noticed a real change when that came into effect. Just because you weren't really enforcing these sort of possession rules for small amounts in the first place, how did you handle public consumption given that? I mean, and what's changed?
Yeah, you know, the single largest change wasn't that suddenly I think there were more and more people using drugs in public spaces. But what is really, really important for people to understand is that when they were, there was in many cases nothing police could do about it.
Right.
So, you know, under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, it's the possession of illicit narcotics that is prohibited. So, and of course, by virtue of that, when you decriminalize the possession, you also decriminalize the use of those illicit drugs. And so what happened was in the past, if we saw someone who was using drugs in a problematic circumstance, like say on a playground or at a beach or at a bus shelter where there were kids waiting to go to school, you know, we could get a phone call from the public or we could come across that ourselves. We could approach that person and say, listen, right now you are in violation of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. That person might even be arrested in that moment. And, you know, we had these tools we could use to move them along and make it clear that that wasn't an acceptable way to use drugs or an acceptable place to use drugs. Once decriminalization came into effect, we no longer had that ability because we literally, in the absence of any other criminal behavior or the person being in an exception to the exemption, like, for example, in a school, we really have no legal grounds to approach them in the absence of any other criminal behavior. And that is the problem. It's not that suddenly you had this massive increase in the number of people you're using outdoors, but when they were doing so in problematic circumstances, historically, we were able to deal with that very effectively.
Right.
And decriminalization, you know, took those tools away from our police officers.
And I mean, I live in a downtown BC community, so I see drug use most days. And it's a minority, but I imagine one of the reasons that is, and what's been so striking for people in the province witnessing is it for the first time, they haven't been moved along, right? I mean, and that,
right.
I think that is, and in some senses, I mean, I know you see this from the front lines, but it has very much undermined the whole idea in some senses.
That's right. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's something that police have been flagging for, like I say, prior to the exemption request even being submitted, because we suspected this would become a serious problem. And there has been a fair bit of confusion around the exemption. You know, Health Canada added extra exceptions to the exemption, three extra exceptions to the exemption only, you know, several months after the exemption took effect, understanding and recognizing that this matter of public consumption was a big deal. But it's been a bit frustrating from a policing perspective because we could sort of see this coming. And, you know, I think if it had been effectively addressed in the beginning, you know, we wouldn't find ourselves in the situation that we're in today.
Right. Because it went back before, though I know the province tried to rectify it, went back before the courts and that was struck down. So all of a sudden now it's a legal issue and then it gets complicated.
Yeah. And, you know, the Public Consumption Act, I think, would have been a very, very good way of addressing problematic issues of public consumption because, you know, it didn't criminalize people who were using drugs. It simply gave police the authority to approach them and say, hey, you need to leave. This is not an appropriate place for you to be using illicit drugs and you have to go. It was only if that person refused to leave that it would become a criminal matter.
Right.
So I feel like it was a really good sort of balance between wanting to, you know, not drive people who use drugs indoors where they use alone and maybe more likely to die, but also, you know, ensuring that a family can go to the beach and know that if there's someone using illicit drugs next to them, there's something the police can do to address that.
Vancouver Police Department Deputy Chief Fiona Wilson is with us. She is president of the BC Association of Chiefs of Police. We're talking about decriminalization, which has been a big hot topic, not just in BC over the last little while, but right across the country. Deputy Chief, when you look at the politicization of it, I know you must watch this from your prism, but it's turned into this sort of, I mean, I'm wondering what you made of, without getting to the politics of it, do you think it's a decriminalization is a wacko policy? Because I didn't think it was.
You know, I think that police leaders, health authorities, government, we were all doing what we could to try and be progressive, think outside the box, and come up with policies that could move the dial on the tragic number of overdose deaths we've been seeing in our communities. So, you know, I don't think it was a wacko idea. And I honestly, even to this day, despite the fact that, you know, we have got some significant concerns with the way the exemption was rolled out. One thing, as I said earlier, that I think most people agree on is that, you know, when somebody has a substance use disorder, it should be treated as a health matter, not a criminal one. You know, we are not going to arrest our way out of this crisis. That is not going to reduce overdose deaths. The problem was the way decriminalization was rolled out, because as always, the devil's in the details. And, you know, if there had been a way to more effectively ensure that people weren't being criminalized by virtue of their drug use, but without putting, you know, other members in community in situations where they felt unsafe, you know, that would have been ideal. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened. And now we found ourselves in the situation that we're in today.
I suppose at this point, the alterations that the province is asking Health Canada for might be a step in the right direction. It will make a difference, I suspect, just listening to how you've described it, if in fact you could start moving people along again who are using drugs in problematic places.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that's a step in the right direction for sure. I think that our members need those tools to be able to effectively address issues of problematic consumption. And, you know, I've said many times in the past that my experience with people who use drugs is that they go out of their way to avoid doing so in front of children and youth. But, you know, there are situations, and we've seen those in our communities, where that's not happening. And it is very, very problematic when somebody's sitting next to you in a Tim Hortons using illicit drugs. Yeah. And, you know, in the absence of any other criminality, or, you know, a refusal to leave after being asked to do so by the business owner, there's really nothing police can do, assuming that it's, you know, it appears to be under 2.5 grams and you're not violating any smoking bylaws, for example, or any other behaving in any other kind of criminal way. And that's really concerning to people in community. You know, we can't just have people willy-nilly all over the place ingesting drugs in places where, you know, kids and families and youth are present.
No, and therein lies part of the problem. In fact, if you look at what happened in Oregon, that was part of the backlash, was really all the same things we're witnessing here, which was a lack of the other puzzle pieces to make decrim work properly, and this sort of aversion to, wait a second, why are there so many people using right out in front of us in the places where our kids play and where we spend time and so on? What would you advise then? Because I know the city of Toronto is looking at this. There are others who sort of decided that this is never going to happen in their communities, or are trying to see if it could work. What would you advise then other police forces from a policing perspective? How would you advise going about doing this? Or would you say, don't bother for now, we haven't quite figured it out?
You know, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the pilot project in British Columbia. And those are still playing out. You know, we're still learning a lot about the unintended consequences of decriminalization. And so I think my advice right now would be to hold off. Let's see how all of this plays out see if there's a compromise or a, you know, solution we can come up with that on one hand isn't going to criminalize people by virtue of their personal drug use, but also is going to ensure that everyone in our communities feel safe. So that would be my advice, just to hold off and see how things play out here in British Columbia.
Well, Deputy Chief Wilson, as always, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ben.
Home has the puck, maintains the LA zone, throws it to the opposite corner. 7 seconds to play. LA can't get it out of its own end. Floated toward the LA bench. McDavid will skate off the remaining time, and the Oilers have advanced to the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Closes out the LA Kings and wins this best of seven series in five.
Wow. I mean, it was hopping in Edmonton last night, and history repeated itself. For the third year in a row, the Oilers knocked off the LA Kings in the first round of the playoffs. They're doing it in fewer and fewer games. I think it took 7 games 3 years ago, 6 last year, now 5. So moving in the right direction. But it was a pretty interesting series for a number of reasons. But Edmonton must be a happy place to be today. Now they wait. Now they wait to find out who wins the Nashville-Vancouver series. And a Vancouver-Edmonton, I don't want to jinx anything, but a Vancouver-Edmonton series would be pretty awesome. Reed Wilkins is host of Inside Sports and the Edmonton Oilers hockey broadcast on 630 Chat. He joins us now from Edmonton. Reed, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Wow. I suppose just because it's just finished, and I and you're going to blame me a bit for talking about Toronto, but I'm in BC. We don't talk about Toronto much out here either. The Leafs are going to game seven. Who knew? Who knew? Here they are.
Yeah, it didn't look good going into game five without Matthews, but they played well tonight. I mean, they came out hitting, and Nylander got a couple of big goals. They kind of, unfortunate for them, that they lost the shutout. I think there was literally a tenth of a second left. I assume that Boston goal counted. I flipped away from it, but I think they were counting it. But yeah, the Leafs played great, and now the storyline is no longer, are the Leafs going to flame out early again? Now the storyline is this going to happen to Boston 2 years in a row, where right. They were the home ice team in the series, up 3-1, lost game five in overtime, lost game six on the road. Now last year they lost game seven in overtime to Florida, and now they're going to be facing questions about that possibly happening again here against Toronto.
Yeah, it's going to be a game seven. It's going to be an interesting one. Reed, listen, it was quite the series. I mean, because I'm on air at the time that they're playing, I don't get to see a lot of it, but I was watching the highlights. The power play, I mean, it sets some record for the most effective power play in a playoff series ever, I think.
Well, I'm going to say this, Ben. I no longer think it's hyperbole to call this the best power play in the history of hockey.
Oh, wow.
I mean, over 25%, what are we at? I think 5 years in a row, incredibly talented players, continuity on it. And a lot of what LA did in last offseason and throughout this season was geared towards stopping the Oilers' power play if they played in the playoffs. And LA had the second best penalty killing in the NHL this season, and were absolutely shredded by the Oilers. And you saw throughout the series how effective the Oilers were. And yeah, a couple of goals were 5-on-3 goals in a blowout win, but they still count. And then last night, even though the stats will say 1-for-5, well, the one power play was only 20 seconds at the end of the game, and two other goals were scored within 4 seconds of a penalty expiring, and the player wasn't really back in the play yet. It's clearly you have McDavid and Draisaitl, who are creative players. They can pass or they can shoot. You have Zach Hyman, who is an outstanding net front player and who is excellent at puck retrieval and body position down low. You have Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, who's a very smart player. He's also a threat to pass and shoot. And then ever since the Oilers traded Tyson Barrie last year at the trade deadline, it's been Evan Bouchard at the blue line, who's an excellent passer and has one of the hardest point shots in the league. And you just see when the Oilers attack on the power play, it's completely relentless and it's creative, but it's structured, yet it's improvised. They have set plays. They have things they want to do if they win the faceoff, but then they're so good at getting the puck back and just figuring out where each other are going to go that's incredibly hard to stop. And they're always moving around. That's the one thing everybody comments on is that, you know, it's not like, okay, Ovechkin's always over there for his one-timer, you know? They're always moving around. I mean, yes, Draisaitl sort of has the one-timer, but, you know, they're always moving around and shooting from different angles and trying different things. And I mean, the special teams were one of the big reasons the Oilers won the series.
Yeah. What's the mood like been like in Edmonton? Because I know with this team each year, and I know there's lots of Oilers fans out here in BC, obviously lots of folks from Alberta out here, that every year there's sort of this expectation about how well the team will play. But after the kind of, you know, sort of the last half of the regular season and now this first round series against the Kings, people must be feeling at least pretty hopeful that this team is actually going to do some things that other teams haven't been able to do.
Well, I think so. I think, quite frankly, this is the best Oilers team on paper since the late 80s. Now, I know they won the Stanley Cup in 1990, had a very good team, maybe a little unexpected. Certainly the 06 team that went to the Cup final kind of didn't put it together until late in the regular season and the playoffs. So if you look at how this team performed and having the 16-game winning streak and really being the best team in the league after they made the coaching change, I mean, the expectations should be high. I think, you know, if you talk about the mood in the city, spirits are high. I think Edmonton is a city in which The overall mood of the citizens often revolves around how the Oilers are doing or how they did
the
night before. And I'm sure, you know, if you saw the highlights, you also saw the gatherings outdoors and all the people who are consuming the games that way. So, yes, it's happy, but I think there's also that looming, it's got to happen soon. You know, McDavid and Draisaitl into their late 20s, which is not old, but expiring contracts within the next 2 or 3 years. And when is it going to happen? And I think there's the recognition that this is a very good team, but the point isn't to be very good not anymore. The point is to be excellent. You know, 10 years out of the playoffs is behind us. You know, this is a peak for this team. And I think that, you know, Connor said it last year after they were eliminated. We used the clip in one of our show intros all year long. It's cup or bust. So I think that is still the ultimate hope. I mean, this isn't like, let's just get into the playoffs. Let's beat Calgary like a couple of years ago. This is about going for the big one.
All right. So I saw someone on social media saying, were they chanting, we want Nashville or we want Vancouver in Edmonton last night? Or were they just not chanting at all and just waiting to see how that unfolds? Because
yeah,
Edmonton-Vancouver series would be great. That would be great.
It would be. I didn't hear a we want chant. No. You know, I have headphones on a lot of the game and I'm working on stuff. I heard a lot of Let's Go Oilers. Yeah. I think from a storyline standpoint, you'd want Vancouver because it's all Canadian. And, you know, Vancouver beat Edmonton all four times they played in the regular season. I think from a storyline standpoint and maybe a series that would bring a lot of casual or non-fans in, you want Edmonton, Vancouver. From my standpoint, you just want to keep winning. I think a win over either team would be pretty sweet if the Oilers could get to the West Final. And people often ask me, well, who do you want to play in the next round? I would say, well, whoever wins is going to be playing better. So that's the more difficult opponent. You know, like I'd want to play the losing team then because they got knocked out. You know, and Nashville, I mean, Edmonton won 16 straight games and then lost their next game. Nashville had a stretch of 17 games where they went, I think, 15-0-2. So it's like the same number of points, you know. So they got a great goalie. They got a great defenseman in Josi. They got Forsberg, who's talented. They got Ryan O'Reilly, who's a great all-around player. So, like, either team is going to be tough.
Yeah. I guess the good news for now, Reed, is that you get another round. You get another round of this because there's nothing better than it. I mean, just listening to it, it's just so much. The energy in the playoffs is so remarkable that each year you forget, you know, you're watching a game in October thinking, oh, this is a bit slow. And then you're reminded every year in the playoffs that it's magical.
Well, that's why it's often, I mean, we're biased in Canada, but that's why it's often called the greatest tournament in sports because it's, it's 2 months. And it's, 2 to 4 games a week, depending on your schedule and how long your rounds are. And it's just so tense, Ben. I mean, in the regular season, okay, a guy got a penalty, whatever, kill it off or they'll score, you know. But in the playoffs, it's like, well, is that the penalty that kills us in the series? Like, is that the one that, and I mean, even look at that, LA was playing a great game in Game 4. They're down 1-0 with 11 minutes left and get a power play. Did nothing and then only got one shot on goal the rest of the way. You know, that's ended that game for them and went a long way towards ending the series for them as well.
It is cruel. Reed, I guess you'll be waiting to see who the Oilers play next. Thanks so much. We'll talk again.
Okay, appreciate it.
It's been a great week for a member of our Chorus family. My Toronto colleague, Mike Ceresia, found out recently that he'll be part of the 2024 class of inductees into the Ontario Sports Hall of Fame. He'll be there alongside figure skating legends Tessa Virtue and Scott Moore, Maple Leafs captain John Tavares, the CFL's Neil Lumsden, and many others. If you don't recognize Mike's name right off the bat, it may be because the sport he absolutely excelled at is racquetball. And it doesn't get a ton of exposure. But over an 18-year pro career that started when he was still a teen, he just knew all kinds of success. Here he is in 1992, by the way. You can find these on YouTube.
We are in Canada. Leif Elsmo, along with Jim Heiser and Lynn Adams, we're all set for a competition between the two number one players in Canada and the United States. Mike Ceresia, wearing the Canadian Maple Leaf, in their red and white, and offsetting those colors in the blue and white with the American flag bandana, Tim Sweeney.
Amazing. So there you have it. I mean, he represented his country, Mike Cirecia did, on 18 occasions between 1988 and 2002, including 8 consecutive world championships. His lowest finished at those was fourth. So imagine how well he did. He also picked up a silver in the men's team event when racquetball was a competition sport at the 1995 Pan Am Games. He had 21 podium finishes at the Canadian Championships in open singles and open doubles events from 1985 to 2003. That is a remarkable run. And so he's being recognized for that astoundingly successful career with that induction into the Ontario Sports Hall of Fame, which will take place a little later this year. So we thought, wouldn't it be cool to talk to Mike about this honor and just what allowed him to get there? And Mike Cirecia joins us now from Toronto. Mike, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Ben. Looking forward to speaking with you.
Well, congratulations. I mean, this is I was looking down the list of people you're being inducted with. That's a pretty heady company you're part of, and what a great honor.
It really is. It really is. When I got the call from the Ontario Sports Hall of Fame president, Mark Gravett, and he told me first that, you know, I was obviously very emotional and excited. And then he told me who the rest of the people that were being inducted. And I was like, wow, that's an amazing group. Like everybody's a household name, save Mike Cirecia.
Well, you might be now. Tell me about the emotions of it, because I mean, you kind of stepped away from the sport many years ago now, decades ago now. But I mean, the legacy of it and your success at it, if you look down just what you accomplished, I mean, it really does stand out.
Yes. I mean, the emotion, you know, I was hoping for the call, but certainly not expecting it. And he sent me a preliminary email. And I certainly kind of had a feeling of what was coming. And then when he told me, I was just shocked. I mean, I think all the hours and years of travel and the practice kind of hit me at once. And I couldn't speak for about a minute. And he was very good about it. He said, yes, Mike, I understand. Yes. And I wasn't talking, but he understood.
I imagine it does bring you back, because I mean, reading just the origin story, you played tennis. I think a lot of kids play racket sports, not necessarily racquetball or squash, because it's a little less penetrable. You kind of need to have a court to play on, which isn't always accessible. But you picked up racquetball pretty quickly, right? I mean, you were good at it kind of off the bat.
Well, it was, you know, I think there's times in your life when there's certain things that are meant to be. And one of my buddies, a few of my buddies started playing racquetball at a club in Sarnia called the Nautilus Racquetball Club. And I said to him, you know what, because I figured I had a pretty good racket lead on them, because I played a lot of tennis and I played a lot of other sports, but I certainly enjoyed tennis a lot. And I said, why don't you guys play for about a month and then we'll get a little cash game going the first time I come out. And they said, okay. So one of my buddies, Rick Vandenberg, he said, all right, we're ready. Let's go. So I was on the court with a $10 rental racket, and I hit the first ball that I hit. I just looked at him and I said, this game is made for me. Huh. And he looked at me and he said, I know. And he said, that's why we've been trying to get you out here. And we started playing a little bit. You know, at the time I certainly had tennis strokes coming under the ball, spinning the ball. I mean, and in racquetball, you don't spin the ball. You hit the ball as flat as you can. So about a half hour into it, this guy comes and knocks on the back window of the court. And he said, can I speak to you for a minute? And I said, yes, of course. And it turns out that his name was Mike Jordan. And he was one of the owners of the club with Harry Tugan. And he said, we're trying to build a junior program, and we'd like you to be one of the prime people that we build it around. And he said, I've got a couple of things that I want to include with this conversation. And I said, okay. So he took me to the pro shop. He gave me a top of the line racket. And he said, all you have to do, your obligation is to come and practice as much as possible.
Mike, sorry, just to take you back. This was the first time you'd played?
First time I played. Like I said, I mean, it was one of those things that was meant to be, because I had no idea, I had no idea what I was doing on the court. Like I said, I was using tennis strokes. I don't know what he saw, but as soon as he said that to me, I went home, told my dad, and my dad said, okay, there's got to be a catch. And he said, call the club, you know, I'll wait here on the phone, book a court for tomorrow and see what's going on. So I booked the call, booked the court, told him who I was, and that was it. They didn't ask me for court fees. They would play tapes of at that time, racquetball was just growing in popularity, and it was on, there was a CBC Classic half hour show every Saturday. So that these Harry and Mike would tape these shows, and I'd watch the video and I'd go and practice the strokes. And yeah, I was in love with it from the first shot.
Yeah, because unlike today, where if you were really into a sport, you could probably go onto social media or YouTube or whatever and find all kinds. And in fact, listeners, if you want to go watch Mike Cerisea play racquetball, you can find them on YouTube because I've been watching them. Back then, there wasn't a lot of exposure, right? I mean, you wouldn't have known much about what professional racquetball looked like.
No. I mean, all the exposure that I had was, I mean, at first was the CBC matches and then watching the best players in Sarnia. So, you know, one of my buddies was Mark Kilbreth, and he was an excellent racquetball player, and I would watch him play and understand what he was, you know, try and learn from what he was doing. And then, you know, you go from there, you start playing, you know, provincial tournaments, and you see where you stand. And then, it, you know, one thing leads to another, and all of a sudden you're a little farther along than you thought you were going to be.
Yeah, because you were farther along than you thought you would be probably pretty quickly, because you were playing international, sort of high-ranking international players within a couple of years, right?
Yes, I played. I started when I was 17, and my days were extremely long. I'd practice 4, 5, 6, 7 hours a day because I knew I was about 7 or 8 years behind all the players that I was trying to catch up to. And within 3 years, I played my first pro match in Davison, Michigan, and I played the number 3 ranked player on tour, and he was just an unbelievably great athlete. And we played basically to a standstill. He ended up beating me in 4 games, but at that point, I knew I was going to be decent at it.
Yeah. Wow. And then, of course, you go on to have this remarkable career. And again, I mean, racquetball is not a sport that people know a ton about, but it does have quite a bit of exposure. I mean, it was and is a popular game out there with a real kind of niche devoted audience.
Yes. I mean, at the peak, we probably had 15 million players. I mean, and wow. it was very popular in Canada. I mean, there's courts everywhere. I mean, in my hometown of Sarnia, we had 30 racquetball courts, and the population was 60,000 people.
Wow.
So with the courts, you know, in Toronto, racquetball is extremely popular. I mean, the main countries were, when I first started playing, were Canada and the US, and then Mexico became a world power. Japan was very good, and all the South and Central American countries, they grew from, you know, the early 80s until now, where most of the top players are from South and Central America.
It must have been great to represent Canada as well. I mean, what a thrill to be able to represent your country, right? And you're talking about, we were looking at the uniforms back in the day, the sort of big bulky maple leaf on the back and so on, but what a thrill to represent your country as well.
Yes, it was. I mean, our first World Championships were in Germany, in Hamburg, and I knew all the U.S. players because I've been playing against them for a few years. But, you know, to go to the opening ceremonies, and it was just an incredible thing to see, you know, over 30 countries represented, everybody's in their uniforms. You know, it's what you would expect to see on a smaller scale at an Olympic event. And the club in Hamburg was fantastic. It was just an awesome first experience. And I just absolutely loved the team aspect of international racquetball.
Yeah. I played a bit of racquetball when I was back at university. I don't know what I'd be like at it now. Do you still play?
I still do. Yes. I still love it. I love it as much as I did back when I started. I still practice about once a week, and I love hitting balls and, just working on my game a little bit. I still love it the way I always did.
So I know the induction actually comes up in the fall. What are you going to be thinking about when you get up there to thank everyone for this? It'll probably be a pretty emotional moment for you.
It's going to be panic. Yeah, Ben, it's going to be panic. Yeah, no, I'm going to be trying. I'll try and be well prepared. But, when you think back on those, you know, the 25 years of main competition that I was involved in, there's so many people that are instrumental in helping you move to the next level. Sometimes it's something small, sometimes it's something big. But yeah, I have so many people that I really appreciate what they did for me over the years. And so it's going to be very emotional.
We always think of those sports as being such individual sports, but you're right. I mean, behind every individual out there on any court are a bunch of people who've helped them get there, right?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, there's always you have your coaches, your advisors, your friends. In racquetball, we had many people that you would bounce ideas off. And certainly, you know, I would say that my number one supporter was my wife, Claudine, who, you know, I met when I was 31. And it's not a big surprise to me that the biggest success I had was from 31 to 41 when I was playing and actually stopped playing the main tournaments in 2004. And she was a huge influence, support, and, you know, certainly understood my addiction to the game and tried to make sure that I had what I needed at all times. She was just fantastic.
Yeah, they must be, the family must be thrilled too, right, for you?
Yes, yes. I mean, because they, you know, that my kids are 21 and 23, so they never really saw me play. That they watched the videos once in a while, but they don't really understand. But when I told them about this, they were just shocked. I mean, they because they know the other people, and they've seen them on TV, seen them in the news, and then they're like, wow, we can't believe you're with that group.
Yeah, like John Tavares and so on. Yeah, it's going to be amazing. Mike, congratulations once again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ben. Have a great day.
I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window. Open it and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Amazing. Network, 1976. You listen to what he says and it could be 2024, right? Maybe a little bit different, but he talks about the Russians, inflation. Interesting, right? Peter Finch won a posthumous Oscar for Best Actor for his role as Howard Beale, of course. Finch would, in fact, die from a heart attack in early 1977. That's why he wasn't there to receive the award. And while there's obviously no connection, obviously, to playing that famed character, I thought of him today when I was reading this article about this correlation between anger and the increased risk of heart problems. Because I always, when I think of anger, I always think of that part of that movie Network. New research is digging into that hypothesis, and it finds that anger could indeed, acute bouts of anger, could indeed be bad for you and your heart. Now, this is linked again to frequent bouts, and it finds that it could bring an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. Here's why. Researchers say that negative emotions causes blood vessels to constrict, then that reduces blood flow, increasing the chance of disrupting processes in the body. I wanted to get a more educated opinion on this. So we called Dr. Joseph Ebinger, who's a clinical cardiologist and director of the Cardiac Intensive Care Unit at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Dr. Ebinger, thank you for your time.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
This is one of those studies that's just kind of, I think the media love these studies, right? Because it basically, if you just draw the parallel, it's like acute anger will lead to heart attacks, which is completely simplistic. But I guess it is kind of intuitive that there would be a link there.
Yeah, we've known from epidemiology studies for years that there's an association between the emotions that we experience and our cardiovascular outcomes. And what this study really gets at is, why do we see that that is occurring?
Yeah, and just without getting too technical for me, mostly not for my audience, what exactly is going on?
Yeah, so what this research study looked at is at blood vessels and what happens to them when people experience emotions like anger, anxiety, and sadness. And what they found in particular for individuals experiencing anger is that the blood vessels aren't able to dilate, aren't able to respond, what we call vasodilate, as well as individuals who experience more of a neutral emotion. And what that tells us is those small, stiffer blood vessels over time can have adverse effects on our cardiovascular system.
Right. And we didn't see this for anxiety and depression, for instance.
Exactly. That wasn't seen for anxiety and depression. Now, that isn't to say that those findings aren't there, but this study maybe just wasn't powered to experience it. To detect it. And that can be from a number of reasons. Not enough folks in the study. Maybe the responses to anxiety and to sadness aren't as strong, or it's just through a different mechanism that they exert their effects on the cardiovascular system.
Right. I mean, this is a foundational study, as they call them. So it's not definitive. It's one of those ones that's like a building block, right?
Exactly. It's a building block. And like I was saying before, we've known, just looking at sort of the histories, that quote unquote type A personality are the individuals who we tend to see develop a lot of cardiovascular conditions. And we've known that that's there for a while. What this really gets to is what's going on at the cellular level, what's going on at the blood vessel level that's contributing to it. And at least for anger, it looks like a driving factor of that may be reduced vasodilation.
Interesting, because they always sort of say, if you're angry, it looks like your head's going to blow, but it could be your heart, right? It could be your heart. It's, I mean, just to get without, again, what is it about the heart that would be vulnerable to that?
Yeah. So the heart, speaking as a cardiologist, I'll say, you know, it is close to my heart, as the pun would be, but the heart really experiences high degrees of stress through this increase in blood pressure,
right,
probably from those blood vessels clamping down. The way I describe that to folks is I want you to think of somebody who's at the gym lifting weights. So I'm in LA, you think of the guys down at Muscle Beach and Venice Beach. You can't see me, but my arms are nowhere close to their sides. And if you sent me down there and tried to make me bench press with a bunch of plates on the end, I wouldn't be able to do it. And that's what your heart's trying to do, is it's trying to basically be the guy at Venice Beach when your blood pressure is really high.
Right.
What you want to do is bring that blood pressure down. You want to lower the load on your cardiovascular system to allow your heart to be effective in getting blood to the rest of your organs.
Right. So it can lift that, it can bench press that weight, but you don't want to, anyone can bench press that weight, but you don't want to have to do it too often.
Exactly. You don't have to do it often or for too long. And this study, importantly, looked at things over a short term. So it tells us that the effects on the blood vessels tend to occur and peak around 30 to 40 minutes after you experience those emotions. And clearly, 30 to 40 minutes isn't going to necessarily affect the rest of your lifespan. But if you have repeated episodes of that over and over, these sort of chronic states of, you know, where you're constantly being stressed, constantly getting angry about things, that over time can contribute to adverse cardiovascular events.
Yeah, because for the purposes of this, I think one of the things that I didn't mention earlier, and I should ask you, was that when we say acute anger, what are we talking about for the purposes of this? Because lots of people will say, oh yeah, I do get angry. I'll have to worry about this. But this was sort of quite specific about what they meant.
Exactly. So they actually used tools to help individuals recall prior episodes that had make them really angry or make them sad or make them anxious. And they were really smart in that they were able to track people's emotions using validated instruments and showed that, yeah, the anger mechanisms really triggered sensations of anger in people, and the sad episodes triggered episodes of sadness and feelings of sadness in them. And so these are very specific pinpoint things. So living in Los Angeles, the example that I would use for folks is when you're stuck behind the slow person in the left lane,
right,
that's
traffic.
An acute episode of anger.
Yeah. I suppose a lot of this is situational too, because I would imagine that this would be, I think the study was done on people without any existing heart conditions, but you would think this would be probably more important for people who have heart disease already to know that the combination of the acute anger episodes and this existing condition might be even more dangerous.
Yeah, I actually think that the, you know, it sort of cuts both ways here. You're right. It was done on younger, generally healthy individuals who didn't have underlying cardiovascular disease. And I think there's two important factors there. You're 100% right that individuals who have underlying cardiovascular disease are likely more at risk for the development of these findings. What it also tells us is that even if you don't have those cardiovascular conditions yet, you also can experience this. And so this tells us that it's important for individuals to be mindful of their mental health, find ways to not ignore, but at least to help them understand their emotions and minimize those effects over the long term.
Dr. Joseph Ebinger is with us this half hour. He's the director of the Cardiac Intensive Care Unit at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. We're talking about new research out this week that has sort of looked into quite something that's been well known for a while, but they continue to investigate, which is a link between acute episodes of anger and an increased risk of heart attack. I mean, you know what happens to your heart when you get really upset, right? I mean, you can feel it, but there is in fact something going on at the vessel level, the blood vessel level, that is actually, it could in fact increase your risks of heart attack over time. Dr. Ebinger, I mean, you mentioned it already, but I suppose what's interesting here is you kind of, if you're at risk of this, you kind of need to find ways to cool out. And I think this is something that cardiologists say generally to their patients about sort of heart health and better living. And one of them is, you know, no unnecessary stress.
Yes. And I think in our modern world, that's easier said than done. But you're 100% right, is minimizing those episodes, those acute episodes of anger are going to be really helpful. And ways that folks can do this are numerous, and we always recommend focusing on your mental health as an important way to keep yourself physically healthy. But there are some sort of things that you can end up doing about that. And one of them that I talk about my patients with on a regular basis is physical exercise.
Right.
Getting out and exerting yourself is clearly good for your cardiovascular system, but there's numerous studies that have also shown that it's good for your mental health and your ability to be able to cope with what otherwise stressful or anger-inducing situations.
Right. Interesting, because oftentimes we're sort of told about heart health, you know, that as at a certain age, you need to sort of watch out for doing too much cardio and so on. I mean, intensive cardio, I'd say. That might not be true, by the way. You can correct me. But that that heart health in terms of managing your mental health is really important too, because sometimes I think we understand it better now. But over time, we've understood the link between mental health and physical health, I think, a lot better than we used to.
Absolutely true. And I always tell folks to listen to their body. Think of, you know, if you're getting out and trying to exert yourself and something doesn't feel right, talk to your doctor. This is what we're here for. But you're exactly right, Ben, in that the link between mind and body has been sort of understood, but we're finally starting to devote resources, like this study did, to examine why those factors exist. And we know this isn't some etherist thing anymore. Like what the author showed, there are true changes that our body experiences in response to these emotions. And it's important for us to understand what those mechanisms are. One, so we can better counsel patients, but two, understanding the mechanism really helps us target ways to help to mitigate or decrease the risk of cardiovascular events for folks who do experience emotions like anger.
So as a cardiologist, what would you like to know? Because again, this is sort of a, as I mentioned earlier, a foundational study. So it's sort of a building block in better understanding the link between something like acute episodes of anger and heart health. What would you like to know more about now? Where do we go from here on this, do you think?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things is the study is focused on three emotions, anger, anxiety, and sadness. And we didn't see the same outcomes for anxiety and sadness. And I think part of it is bigger studies are going to be really helpful at helping us to detect smaller differences that may occur. So that's one thing. I'm also interested in, what about positive emotions? Individuals right. who are experiencing episodes of joy, of happiness, of relief. Do we see those same, or do we see those different emotions causing the opposite effect? Do we see better cardiovascular health? And is that a way that we could try and help individuals sort of reach a balance in their life from their mental health that also helps to balance and benefit their cardiovascular health?
Would it be so interesting if laughter was actually good for your heart?
I mean, we've said forever it's the best medicine, and it would love to know if that was actually had some physiologic proof behind it.
Dr. Ebinger, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Foreign interference in our democratic institutions is a very serious issue. It requires us to investigate, analyze, and reflect as thoroughly as possible in order to ultimately identify the best ways to counter it, or if it's not possible to prevent it entirely, to limit its effects.
That was Justice Marie-Josée Hogue back in late January. She launched the hearings at the inquiry into the allegations of foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections. The Quebec Court of Appeal Justice is assessing interference by China, Russia, and other foreign states and non-state actors, including any potential effects on those two general elections. She began sorting through what kind of information could be made public and what should be shielded from the public eye before moving on to a series of witnesses this past spring. You may remember we talked about that quite a bit on the show. They included everyone from the Prime Minister, his Chief of Staff, Katie Telford, several Liberal cabinet ministers, the current and former heads of Canada's spy agency, CSIS, opposition MPs who were targeted, including former Conservative MP from the Lower Mainland, Kenny Chu, a former Conservative Party leader, Aaron O'Toole, Michael Chong, and many, many others. Perhaps there was no more scrutinized testimony than that of the Prime Minister, because he was asked about what he knew about the allegations of Beijing's alleged interference, amongst others. But certainly in this case, there was a lot of focus on China and when and what was done about it. Here, Trudeau, and he's talking about the reports that were produced by my next guest with help, but by my next guest, says the government was limited on how it could respond to media reporting on foreign interference. He says the government couldn't correct the record without potentially putting security agencies at risk of giving information away to our adversaries.
Yeah, these were conversations around what I could say and what we could and couldn't say. around some of these allegations that were in the paper, but would leave us limited on what we could actually rebut, regardless of the fact that there was there were inconsistencies.
Inconsistencies. It was an interesting use of that word, because one of the big problems with the foreign interference issue for this government seems to be their inability to take it seriously, or at least not, they didn't take it very seriously until it was too late, right? So if you remember back, the Globe and Mail and Global start to report allegations of foreign interference in these elections, not sort of earth-shattering changes, but really important stuff, that in fact there was concerted efforts by Beijing to meddle, at least in certain ridings, to favor candidates that they thought were friendlier to Beijing, certainly to target candidates that they didn't think were friendly. And of course, at the time, the conservatives had taken a relatively harder line on Beijing than the liberals had. And so there was this idea, perhaps, and this is what this inquiry is digging into, that if there was stuff going on and that the government was being told by CSIS that it was happening, that perhaps they turned something of a blind eye to it because it was benefiting them. Now, that has not been established. It hasn't. But that's one of the main questions that is this inquiry is looking into. Whether or not they'll actually pronounce on that is another issue. It'll probably be a lot more bureaucraties than that. Needless to say, though, you know, the government started off by appointing former Governor General David Johnston as a special rapporteur to look into this, to recommend whether or not we needed a public inquiry. That went up in flames. Of course, you'll remember that well, when Johnston was essentially accused of being a little too close to Trudeau, the Trudeau government, and to Trudeau personally, to actually carry this out. I mean, whether or not he was able to do it or not is another issue, but certainly the appearance of it, him being too close, became a big, big problem. And of course, you know, the opposition made a lot of it. But he recommended there be no public inquiry, that it wasn't worth it, that there, you know, that whatever he had managed to see, that this just wasn't worth the time. Eventually, the government caves to ongoing pressure and more articles, including from my next guest, Robert Fife, the Globe and Mail Ottawa bureau chief, that essentially suggests there is a problem that needs to be looked into here, and that the best way to do it would be in an inquiry format whereby witnesses can be called and they can testify essentially under oath, right? And it's always amazing to see a prime minister testify under oath about what they knew, what they didn't know, what they did about it, and so on. Now, needless to say, the team at the Globe and Mail's Parliamentary Bureau has been watching this one very closely, because their reporting, along with that of Global News, is really what blew the lid off this whole foreign interference story. So what will they be looking for tomorrow? And I should couch this. I've covered these things before. Sometimes the reports can be really revealing, and sometimes they're just a lot of bureaucraties. So I'll be looking forward to seeing what Justice Hogue puts into this report tomorrow. She didn't have much time to write it, by the way. I mean, they just wrapped up the witnesses about a month ago, and it's due tomorrow, May the 3rd. They pushed that back, actually. It was supposed to be originally due, I think, at the end of February, and they demanded they have more time. But this is pretty rushed. She heard some pretty interesting stuff, but it will be fascinating to see what she actually puts down in writing, what conclusions she comes to. And this is just a preliminary report. There will be another report on recommendations that's due out, I think, by the end of the year. But what will the Globe and Mail team, what will Bob Fife be looking for tomorrow? And how much damage could it do to an already quite wounded Trudeau government? Joining me now from Ottawa is the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau Chief, Robert Fife. Bob, welcome back. Thank you.
Happy to join you.
It's funny, there's a lot of anticipation around this, but I think a lot of people out there are wondering exactly what to expect tomorrow. So just a reminder of what we're going to hear out of this report tomorrow, because it is really a preliminary report, and it was done quite quickly, really.
Yes, well, the inquiry has certain guardrails on it. The first phase is dealing with the 2019 and 2021 elections about foreign interference. Largely, this deals with Chinese foreign interference. And then there's going to be a second phase that is going to deal with, you know, are there countries such as India and Iran and Russia, but also what are the solutions to curbing foreign interference? What should be done? And so we'll expect that, and that and recommendation, and that final report will be delivered in December of this year. So it's really it's going to be a very limited report in terms of what was the effect of foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections? Did the prime minister know about this foreign interference? Did he ignore the CSIS warnings, or did they play the CSIS warnings down? Did CSIS do a proper job in terms of informing the government? Did they pound the table loud enough? And did the election monitoring organizations that were responsible for both election campaigns, did they do their job? Why didn't they, when they were informed of Chinese state and proxy efforts to influence the election campaigns and use disinformation, why wasn't the public informed of this, or the candidates informed of this? That's the kind of thing that we're looking for in tomorrow's report. And I have no idea what Justice Marie-José Hoge is going to say. None at all. And when we watched the hearings, the commission counsel was very focused on process, how things worked, how intelligence went, who got the documents, how did you do your job, how did you see your job? Whereas the lawyers for the political parties and the diaspora communities were much more focused and asked much better questions about, well, why didn't you tell MPs, or Prime Minister, why didn't you read this, or why did you ignore this? I mean, there's a CSIS document that said, the Vancouver Consul General was bragging about defeating Kenny Chiu as a Conservative MP in 2021. Mm-hmm. You knew this. What did you do about it? Well, I didn't, just because they're bragging doesn't mean that they had any influence. And, also he questioned the CSIS intelligence. So I have no idea what she's going to say. There's stuff about Han Dong. What's she going to say about Han Dong as well? So,
yeah, I guess we just don't know, right? I mean, the thing is, because of your reporting and because you watched a lot of the testimony, obviously, it's really interesting to get your take on it, because I felt like we learned things sort of through osmosis as this process went on. I mean, it was clear that, we sort of went in thinking, who knew what, when, and what did they do about it, right? I mean, I think those were the big questions you put to me the last time we spoke. And I think we got a clue as to who knew what, when, and maybe a little bit about what they didn't do about it, but we started to get a bit of a window into why. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, look, we know that the prime minister and his top aides were told about some of this. And we certainly know that the election monitoring organizations were definitely told about Chinese foreign interference, but they didn't take it particularly seriously. And they made the view that, well, they didn't want to warn the public, and they're not sure that it was that serious, and it didn't have any effect on the overall results of the election campaign, particularly in 2021, where there was really evidence of very strong Chinese foreign interference or disinformation campaigns against the Conservatives. But the monitoring groups kind of played that down, and they kept saying, well, there was no evidence that it affected the overall results of the election. And of course, nobody has suggested otherwise, including Aaron O'Toole, the Conservative leader at the time. He said, no, I lost fair and square, but I think that this disinformation campaigns and heavily Chinese Canadian writings did have effect in suppressing the vote for the Conservatives, and we may have lost anywhere from 5 to 9 seats. I don't think she's going to pronounce a judgment on that. I mean, how do you know what somebody's going to do when they go into a polling booth? But clearly this was going on, and whether she will say, you know what, you should have warned the parties about this. I don't know whether she'll say that or not, but that's one thing. She may very well say, Prime Minister and your top aide, you were warned about this. You really didn't take it very seriously. I can't speak to your motives. Why? Obviously, she won't speak to motives, but she very well may say you didn't take it seriously. Or she could simply say CSIS didn't do a good enough job of trying to get this information to your desk. So who knows, right?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, because if it didn't affect the outcome of the election is the bar. That's a pretty, that bar is not necessarily a very helpful one, because I think we had seen, and you know this as better than I do, that there was interference going on in other countries. So we should have been taking our cues from that a little bit. And I just, listening to the prime minister talk about it, he made a perfect amount of sense, but I wasn't quite convinced as to all of a sudden why he would decide, well, CSIS, you can't really trust everything they say, or, diplomats, they always brag about the outcomes of elections. I don't think that's necessarily true.
No, I totally agree with you, but I don't know whether how she's going
right.
to interpret that or see that.
Is there a big question in here that you really, I mean, with all the reporting that you and Stephen Chase have done, was there a big question here that you really wanted answered when you heard people standing up and sort of answering these questions at the inquiry?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all comes down to this. Does she believe that the prime minister was properly informed? Mm-hmm. And what does she think about why they decided to either ignore it or downplay it? I mean, really, that's the issue, isn't it?
Certainly
the senior civil servants who were responsible for oversight of the election campaigns certainly didn't seem to take it very seriously. She may say, well, that's fine. You did your job. It wasn't that serious. I don't know. But she might very well say, maybe we shouldn't be having senior civil servants who answer to the prime minister's office in charge of election oversight. Maybe we need to have truly independent watchdog overseeing federal elections so that there isn't this sense that, you know, your career could be limited if you come out and, you know, criticize the government.
Robert Fife is the Globe and Mail's Ottawa bureau chief. We're talking about the release tomorrow, Friday, of the first report from the inquiry into foreign interference into the 2019 and 2020 elections from Justice Marie-José Hoeg. Robert, one of the things that's been really interesting about this is just the political fallout, because it seems quite clear from the way that David Johnston was appointed that the Liberals didn't really want to have this inquiry. We don't really know why that is. Maybe we know more now. But politically, I don't think they thought this was advantageous. And here we are. We're about to see the first report.
Well, it hasn't been advantageous because the evidence and the testimony we saw to date is far different than what David Johnston, who was appointed as a special rapporteur, had to say. I mean, he played down everything. He absolved the prime minister of everything. No need for public inquiry.
Yeah.
There's no evidence that the prime minister ignored anything. And then as for Han Dong, well, the global report was false on Han Dong and all these election irregularities. Well, there's no evidence that Han Dong knew anything about that. And of course, that is completely different than the evidence and testimony that we've seen at the inquiry. So clearly, the public inquiry has been very, very useful because Mr. Johnston was sweeping a lot of stuff under the carpet.
Yeah.
Now, I don't whether she criticizes Mr. Johnston or not. I don't know, but
I'd be surprised. But you never know, yeah. Just without actually coming out and saying it. For listeners because Han Dong is a name you may have heard many times. He is a Toronto area MP who was within the Liberal caucus. He was then booted. But his name has come up a lot in this whole inquiry. One of them is because he was having conversations with the Chinese Consul General in Toronto, frequent conversations, as it turns out. And another was around his nomination, where it turned out that all these international students were being bussed in to vote for him. And this sort of raised, it's funny how much is sort of centered around his particular story as being kind of evidence of what this could look like when it's being done in practice.
Well, I mean, what Mr. Johnston said, well, you know, there were irregularities. It could have come, it might have certainly, there were suspicions that it came from China, but we couldn't prove that. Well, CISA said that, in fact, there was evidence that China was intimidating students to vote for Mr. Han Dong in the nomination process in 2019. And, you know, the government's respond to this, well, yeah, but we were told that, but they were developing plans, but they never did it. That's kind of evidence that we now heard from in the inquiry, or that Mr. Dong changed his tune. He had to revise a statement saying, well, in fact, I did go and see these international students. And yeah, we bussed them to the nomination meeting. I forgot to tell you guys, I just remembered it when my wife jogged my memory and my lawyer jogged my memory. And in terms of the conversations with the Chinese Consul General in Toronto, Mr. Johnston said, well, this idea that he had suggested that they delay the release of the Michaels for political reasons, he said that was false. Well, Global wasn't 100% right on this, but it wasn't false the way Mr. Johnston portrayed it. I mean, he did say to them, if you release them, all it will do is just reinforce the hardline Canadian, hardline Beijing view of China. And he's always said, anytime he did an interview, he's always saying, anytime I spoke with a Chinese diplomat or the consul general, I always said, you've got to release the Michaels right away. That conversation, which we saw the summary of in testimony, never once said, hey, by the way, can you release these people right away? In fact, what he did say to them was, you know, maybe you could set a date for a trial and that might placate Canadians. So
that sounds like he again, was giving them political advice, Bob. That sounds like he was counseling advice. Them on Canadian politics.
And his testimony before the inquiry, I mean, he was sweating and humming and hawing, and it was a terrible performance for him, which means he will never get back in the Liberal caucus and he will not be running for the party in the next year's election campaign. You can be sure of that.
Yeah, politically, when you look at this, I mean, we often talk about, we look at the polls now, people talk about housing and affordability and so on. But I don't think it's a coincidence that when you started reporting a lot of this in the Globe last year, that started sort of this precipitous fall for the Liberals. I mean, I think this isn't the kind of thing people go, this is not a ballot box question, but I think it's done a lot of damage to this. It feels like it's done a lot of damage to the Prime Minister and the party, just in terms of people's overall impression of them because of the sense that they were kind of asleep at the wheel on this one.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, the housing crisis, high inflation and the economy are the reasons why they're really down, but it did hurt them. I mean, you have to remember when we started doing these stories, and as well as Global, his first response is that, you know, the reporters were being racist mm-hmm. by writing stories like this. And then it was conservatives lost. It never affected the overall results, which nobody's ever said. And then it was the conservatives are sore losers. And there's no need for a public inquiry. And then when they were forced to have one, they tried the David Johnston, who is a family friend, had sat on the Trudeau Foundation. It was so blatantly wrong. And that blew up on them. And then they finally had to call a public inquiry. And they dragged that out for basically 8 months before they announced the public inquiry, which they had no choice to, because even the NDP, which had been backing them, had said there had to be a public inquiry. So they beat themselves up and hurt themselves politically by the way they handled this. Yeah. Just like they did on the SNC-Lavalin scandal, the same thing, you know?
I was going to say, I mean, Bob, you've seen so much of this go on over the years. I'm always fascinated why you think a certain story really matters. And you have obviously thought from the get-go that this story really matters.
Well, look, it matters in two senses. First of all, members of the diaspora communities, particularly in the Chinese-Canadian community, are being intimidated by Chinese state actors. And not only intimidated, but there are disinformation campaigns on WeChat and in Chinese media and print media, television media, and social media to try to influence Chinese Canadians to vote in a certain way. That is serious. As you know, Aaron Toole said, if one vote is changed because of that, that's serious in a democracy. Mm-hmm. It cannot be discounted. It cannot be the way this government operated. In some ways, it almost looked, Ben, that the government knew this was going on and they decided to turn a blind eye because it benefited them and hurt the conservatives. Now, whether she says something like that, probably not, but that's the way it came across to, I think, a lot of Canadians.
Yeah. Well, Rob, we'll be watching tomorrow. As always, Robert Fife, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
This is a really interesting story that was featured this week. The Canadian Press did a really nice article, a really interesting article about this. Conestoga College, based in Kitchener, Ontario, was a pretty standard and fairly small community college or polytechnic, as it's referred to. That's changed very quickly over recent years as the school has moved to attract an ever-growing number of international students to take advantage of higher tuition fees and make up for shortfalls in funding, right? In fact, many schools were presented with this option. We're cutting your funding, but you can go out and get international students to make up for that difference. They pay more. And obviously the whole visa system was set up so that you could bring lots of them in, tons. How big did this become at this one place? The student population on its 11 campuses has more than doubled in the last 4 years, reaching about 45,000 students, and international students now significantly outnumber their domestic counterparts. Last year alone, Conestoga had 37,000 study permits approved or extended, the most in Canada, and a 31% increase over the previous year. It's been profitable. they have a $106 million surplus for 2022-2023. That's a big difference from the $2.5 million surplus they posted about a decade ago. In fact, Immigration Minister Mark Miller singled them out in a recent speech back in March, saying there's at least one institution in Ontario that had a $100 million positive balance at the end of the year, and that, in my mind, isn't the vocation of a college or a university. Of course, he later announced, soon after, that they're actually putting a cap on foreign students that could see that colleges and many others, their ability to recruit international students, cut significantly.
To ensure that there is no further growth in the number of international students in Canada for 2024, we are setting a national application intake cap for a period of 2 years. For 2024, the cap is expected to result in approximately 364,000 approved study permits, a decrease of 35% from 2023.
Mark Miller there. Leopold Koff is a local union president representing faculty, counselors, and librarians at Conestoga College. Vicky Poirier is also a union president who represents support staff at the same college. They join me now. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.
Leopold, I suppose just to begin at the beginning, if for those who mightn't have heard of Conestoga College, what kind of institution is it, and what kind of students does it generally attract?
Well, Conestoga College is a full-frame community college, although it's referred to as a polytechnic, which I tend to agree with. It covers everything from one-year and certificate programs up to four-year degree programs, and it's even looking at getting into master's programs in all the fields. So we have everything from trades programs and apprenticeship programs all the way through to engineering, science, health sciences, nursing, degree programs as well, and so it's just growing and expanding in terms of skill sets and labor requirements.
Right. And so that's certainly attractive, not just to students within Ontario, but probably students abroad as well. Tell me how much things have changed, Leopold, just in the past little while, because when you look at the numbers, the growth in the student population at Conestoga seems almost unbelievable.
Well, 1,500% growth in student numbers in the last 2-3 years. That represents a growth curve that no organization, no matter who they are, could ever absorb and do well in terms of that kind of growth curve. And it has been very demanding and stressful for everyone involved.
Yeah, Vicky, tell me a bit about just how, I realize there's one sort of, there's a principal campus in Kitchener, there are others, but how much has life changed on at Conestoga writ large? And how many more students are you dealing with?
1,500 and some odd percentage of student increase over right. The past little while.
That is, and we're talking, I think it's tens of thousands of students more now than there used to be about four or five years ago, right?
Yes, a lot of students.
Right. Leopold, where are they coming from? Because I think we've seen that Conestoga has been singled out quite frequently as having approved the most study permits for international students of any educational institution in the country last year, 37,000.
Well, it's exceeded any levels that University of Toronto has been able to achieve. So that gives you an indicator of how much we have. But the percentage of international students to domestic students currently on campus is about 85% international students.
Wow.
And of those, primarily, not all, but primarily majority are from India, various parts of India. Although we are attracting some more from South America and various other kind in Africa as well. But primarily, I'd say that 85% of the international students, in addition to being 85% of the total student population, is from India primarily these days.
Vicky, how has that impacted, when you grow that fast, how has that impacted the folks that you represent at the college?
Well, we look at workload. We look at even the way that their roles are. They've changed. And even the psychological impact. You know, I've compared it as being more reactive rather than proactive when it comes to making sure that those supports are in place for our students. And so while I'm extremely proud of our members and how they have been able to pivot and ensure that, you know, the success of our students and the college, it has come at a price.
Leopold, just tell me a bit about where the students are coming from and how they're being recruited. I mean, how do you find that many students to come to a school in southwestern Ontario that isn't exactly at the top of sort of international rankings and so on?
Well, one of the primary recruiting sources is, of course, a company called Apply Board. And they are, it's an organization that was started up by graduates of Conestoga College in a postgraduate certificate program. They have a very close tie in, and in fact, we could almost call it a incestuous kind of relationship in some respects. Vicky, you want to jump in and maybe add a little more on this, I believe?
When we talk about how, you know, how the students come in, we have an admissions process and we have an international department. Whereas when you try to bring in, or you do bring in, such a high number of international students and you have a ply board, there is a bit of I'm not going to say a conflict, but there is a scratch your head moment where you're thinking, how do all of these students get processed if they're supposed to come through the Conestoga College admissions process?
Right. Leopold, what's driving this? I mean, I was reading, I think the surplus was above 100 million, and that was up from just a fraction of that, you know, a few years back, maybe a decade ago. So is this all about money? Is that really what this is about, attracting foreign students who pay more money in tuition? And that's it, bottom line?
Ontario, traditionally, for post-secondary, has been underfunding the system for decades. And the only other state and board, education board, if you will, in North America is Arkansas, I think, which has lower funding than Ontario, traditionally. And as a result of that deficit budgeting that they've had to struggle with for decades, now that they have this river of money, it's like they're drunk with the money coming in. And they just, they want more because they don't know how to deal with it. And I don't blame them. I understand where it's coming from, but it's not an excuse for what it's caused. The issue is that, are we doing it right? Is this money that we should feel good about morally in receiving and taking advantage of?
Right. So if I hear you correctly, you know, the colleges were facing a funding issue, so they went out to attract international students, which made sense for their bottom line. Obviously, the international students want to come for the education, makes sense for them too. So the whole thing makes sense, except it has to be done within a certain proportionality.
And the government set it up too, because they took a haircut to the budgets of the colleges a few years ago for government, and they cut tuition fees for domestic students. So and they couldn't colleges could also not charge for extra fees that right. They, you know, was an option. So but international students, though, there was no cut, there was no limit, and they were charged three times more in tuition than domestic students, without any restrictions by the government. And the government said, fine, go for it. If you can get them, bring them in. We don't have a problem. And the immigration policy that if you come here and study and graduate, you get landed immigrant status, that precipitated that. So the federal and provincial government were working together on developing this situation. Now, we do need immigration. No argument. We need immigration. You know, we know the numbers and the demographics.
Yeah. And international students, obviously. Right.
But you know, all of these things came together, you know, like in a perfect storm to create the situation now where we have students who come here under dire circumstances, desperate circumstances. Are they also well vetted? Do they actually verify that they're going to be successful in post-secondary? We have discovered as faculty that most of the students don't have the basic three R's. They don't have the basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. Don't have critical skills thinking. They're like grade school students coming into post-secondary. That's the skill level that they're coming to us with. And that's never been vetted or verified or confirmed or supported in providing the upgrading in their knowledge or skill level so they can be successful when they paid this money to come here and do what they're doing.
Leopold Koff and Vicky Poirier are both union presidents representing respectively faculty counselors and librarians and support staff at Conestoga College in southwestern Ontario. It has 11 different campuses centered in Kitchener, and it has had an exponential growth in international students over the last 4 years or so. It's doubled, I believe, up 1,500%, as both Vicky and Leopold were saying. Vicky, then in that sense, well, how do you fix this then? Because I know the government's passed some new rules about how many international students will be allowed to come in. Each province will be allocated a certain number, and that's going to have a huge impact on Conestoga, as far as I can tell.
Bottom line, Ben, is that the province needs to properly fund our public education. Needs to be done. Should have been done long ago.
Right. This was, in other words, a solution and a problem that got fixed in the wrong way.
Absolutely.
And recently, the government commissioned a report which verified that, but the government didn't actually comply with the recommendations made as to the proper level of funding that should be put in place. But the second part of that, and this is an opportunity now, the pause button can be put on this whole situation. This college system in Ontario, the 24 colleges, was set up by a conservative government almost 60 years ago by Bill Davis. This whole system of the community colleges is not the same as it was. The requirements are changed. The scope and breadth of what they're delivering has changed. The structure and governance has to also be reviewed. So the whole Colleges Act, I propose, should be reviewed and revised to suit the current reality of what the colleges are, what they've become, what they're trying to deliver. And so structure and governance needs to be reviewed. It would be great if the current conservative government would initiate such a change, kind of like an enhancement of what was started by a previous conservative government. Yeah. But we can only hope that one government will one day revisit the college system and revise it.
Vicky, when you look at this, I mean, I think a lot of people will struggle to understand why a college would accept so many students when clearly its faculty and its support staff have been saying, listen, we can't provide a proper education or even proper support for all these people coming in. What is the perverse sort of incentive here? Who's making the money? Is there money being made in many places, do you think?
I'm not making any money.
Real estate development is making, because colleges buying up a lot of property.
Right. I mean, it makes sense for them to want to grow. Ultimately, though, I think one of the things, and you've been pointing this out, you've both been pointing this out, is if the whole purpose of this is to provide quality education to qualified students, that money can't be the driving force. And maybe Conestoga has come to somewhat exemplify that suddenly and for no, you know, in a system that was a bit gamed to push it in that direction to begin with.
Definitely. And the other issue is, of course, the maintenance of quality and standards, not just for the current and future graduates, but also the deliverables to the employers, future employers. Are they going to actually see any credibility in hiring any graduates of Conestoga? Conestoga talks about the graduate, a level of employment upon graduation, but do they actually work in the fields that they have been trained in? That's the question mark that needs to be asked. And that needs to be drilled down into. The other point is that the integrity and equality is also impacts those previous graduates who their diploma on the wall may not have the brand or the credibility anymore if academic integrity keeps dropping as it has been lately.
Right. So, Vicky, in the short term, though, I mean, term is over. So short term, the term is actually done. I think you're done for the spring term at least. But what are you going to do now between sort of in the near future? Because this is going to remain a problem.
So I think now, like, the staffing level that we have now needs to be kept. Then we can provide a good, robust process for students, because though our population for students grew at such a high level, I mean, 250 at the most hired in support staff, that's not the same amount, right? We still have work to do. We still have to recruit students. Maybe just in a different manner, and we still have to run those programs within the college.
Right. And Leopold, last word to you. Just where do we go? I mean, is Conestoga become the cautionary tale that it appears to be about sort of exponential growth in international students and sort of gorging on that river of money that you talked about?
Well, I think in a way it is a model of that, the worst case scenario. But yes, I agree in the sense that in general, it could be looked at as a case study. I use that term as a case study of looking at what we didn't do right and that could have been done better, and that others can learn from that experience as well as ourselves as we move forward in a better way and in a proper way.
Right. But as Vicky put it, bottom line, the issue here is funding, period. Where you get it from has become, the symptom, but the cure is more funding.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, thank you both. I appreciate your time and your insight tonight.
Thank you
very much. Thank you,
Ben. Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.